Sarah and Nippy were both looking for more focus in their lives, more mental self-discipline, more success. Many of us have been there. They wanted to confront the psychological baggage they were carrying around that might be holding them back. Sure, of course, makes sense. Sounds healthy. So they found some classes that seemed to help other people, tried them. The classes seemed promising. They kept at it. And after a while, without fully realizing it, they were deeply embedded in an organization, one that promised growth and healing, but that attacked their sense of self and their place in society. A group that made obedience to the group and subservience to its charismatic leader the most important things in the world. A group that turned out to be involved in crimes like sex trafficking, forced labor, wire fraud, racketeering. Sarah and Nippy were in a cult called Nexium for a long time. It messed them up in ways they're still working through. But they got out, and they're talking about it, including here. It's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. You're free to come and go as you please. I have no doomsday scenario. I have no compound for you to go live on. I do like to think I have a modicum of charisma, and later on I will ask you for money, but it's just a podcast. This is not a cult, I promise. I've always been fascinated by the mental health aspect of cult membership. How is someone doing psychologically before they joined up? What happened to their mind during their time with the cult? And how was their mental health after being in a group like that? I think it's comforting to think, well, I could never be sucked into something like that. I'm too smart. I'm too aware. But I think a lot of us feel psychologically incomplete at times, adrift, in some form of peril. I know I do. And if someone charismatic comes along, welcomes you in, lets you be a part of something, seems to be able to help, how can you not listen? Nexium was founded by a guy named Keith Raniere. There were introductory classes that built into much more intensive, expensive, and demanding commitments. Members were encouraged to move to Albany, New York to be together. You could move up in rank. Raniere was seen as a Christ-like figure. There was a surprising amount of late-night volleyball, which isn't typical for cults, but still interesting. Many women, including Sarah, were branded with Raniere's initials on their skin. The group included a lot of young women, many of whom were in the entertainment industry. Allison Mack from the TV show Smallville was one of the most famous and influential members. Sarah Edmondson and Nippy Ames featured prominently in the HBO documentary series The Vow about Nexium. Nippy is a nickname, by the way. His middle name is Nippert, which is his mom's maiden name. Sarah and Nippy now host a podcast called A Little Bit Culty, about fanaticism, cults, and cult-like groups. I asked them how they got into Nexium in the first place.
We have kind of separate timelines. We joined separately. We met there. I joined in 2005. Nippy joined a few years earlier, was in and out, but then came back around the time when I was just getting started. So we met actually in 2006, and then we were there until 2017. And so it's coming up on our five-year departure anniversary.
Okay. And you left together then in
2017? We left at the same time, yeah.
Okay. Correct. Okay. What was the state of your mental health before you got involved with Nexium? Were you, had you experienced depression, or were you searching for something? Like who were you psychologically at that point?
I like this question because the misconception and kind of the knock on people like this is, oh, you were vulnerable and whatever. We're all going to be vulnerable in our lives. When I signed up for this, I was probably at one of the least vulnerable times in my life, meaning I was in New York. I was 26, 27. I was having fun. I was working. I was applying myself to, auditions and, really like going out and applying a structure to something, a system of acting that isn't necessarily set up for success. And it's very nebulous on how you're doing feedback, et cetera, right? And I had an old high school girlfriend who had just taken a training and we had dated. And when we dated, I had books on JFK, Troy Aikman, all the people that I like looked up to as mentors, because whenever I went into something, I wanted to be successful at it. And this is, you know, it was the strategy that I applied to it. And she's like, look, this is all about the things you talk about, being principled and all that sort of stuff. And I said, sounds good. Sounds like a cult. I'm not doing it. Literally. It's like, I'm not joining your cult. It's like, it's good for you, not for me. And about a year in, she had applied some of the stuff to her life. And I was like, okay, I'll come check it out. And it ended up being a goals program. That's how it was sold to me. So it seemed to me I was going there to get more of a structure and figure out what might be stopping me from being more successful quicker. So,
So it was a self-help thing.
Yeah. It wasn't like, you know, hey, I was down and out. And that, in conjunction, to be totally honest, I was still interested in her romantically. So there was kind of two things. I was like, well, if this can happen romantically with her and it's a goals program, great. I was involved for about a year and a half. And then I left.
Two motivations.
Yeah. And then I left.
Strong ones.
And I left because I didn't think the organization was really much more in a goals program and it was going to grow. And then about 3 years later, I got back involved and it was a totally different organization. So.
And were you still thinking of it as, hey, this is someone to coach me along to be me, or this is a cause that I believe in and I'm loyal to this leader, and you know, the kind of classic religious cult kind of tendencies?
Excellent question, because I think this is a case by case for everyone. For me, it was a goals program and I treated it like that. When I got invited back to work on a film in 2006, it was for work. Now, I had had my hangups with Keith, thought he was weird, never knew that he was what we ended up exposing, right? So it was never, I'm going to go back and follow Keith. It was more, this is a positive program for goals. They're talking about building a better world, talking about ethics, things that I'm aligned with. And then it had an acting director's component when I returned in 2006. So it was blending both worlds for me in that regard. Slowly, I became a teacher, and by 2008, 2009, I was teaching. So I made the transition from kind of giving up my goals in terms of that's the singular reason I was there to
helping others.
Now I'm a church member and I'm teaching the class, so to speak. You know, I made the curriculum. I pursued one of the career paths within the organization. So there's that shift of I was there for me. Now I'm working for them. If that makes sense.
Was that a turning point moment where you said, okay, I'm going to drop this and do this, or did it just happen gradually?
I think it's sort of over time, right?
It happened over time, but it was also very difficult to not be in the city where you're supposed to be auditioning. So I was teaching these things in New York, but...
Mostly Albany.
And it was just, I was missing auditions, and slowly it became, this was a priority. And frankly, had a little bit more of a structure to it than hoping to get an audition. So...
Mm. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of components that went into it, and the organization looked like it was growing. So all my concerns when I left, like, to be totally honest, like, I left because I felt like I was surrounded by a bunch of people who weren't very successful. I didn't want to be the person that was going to be left struggling to drag what I perceived as, and this sounds bad, but I felt like they were losers. They weren't very entrepreneur. They weren't achieving their goals. And about when I returned in 2006, it had more successful, credible people.
A lot of film industry people and artists. And
it felt like more my tribe than most people that were kind of down and out in it. And it has a mixture.
Did it remind you of Scientology, or did you make that connection?
You know, I had heard of Scientology, but I didn't have enough context to compare it to that.
Okay.
But some people that had taken Scientology said that Keith stole from Scientology and he's doing it more ethically. Whatever that meant. But again, I didn't have context and I wasn't looking at it as an organization to work for. Initially.
We didn't think it was a religion either. Like we didn't see it that way.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, how about you? What was your state of mind when you got involved?
Mine was definitely different. So just a bit of backstory. My mom is a therapist. My dad's a counselor. I've been in that world for like a long time. My parents split up when I was really young. They put me in play therapy. I've done like anger management programs. I've taken different seminars and workshops. I'm very open to personal growth and development. And in my early 20s, and I moved back from Montreal where I was getting my theater degree, I was feeling kind of stuck in my career. And I started a women's group for like a support group. mostly actor friends that I kind of ran, even though I wasn't like a trained professional or anything. And we did The Artist's Way. Do you know that book?
A little bit, but fill us in what that is.
Yeah, it's a book by Julia Cameron. It was huge like 25 years ago or so, like in the early 90s. No, late 90s, early 2000s. And it was a workbook for creative people to help like reconnect to your creative side and like unleash your inhibitions and think outside the box. And it was great. I think it's still great. And so I got these women together and we were, you know, working through our creative blocks. But I realized I couldn't really get people past a certain point because I'm not a therapist, you know. And at the same time, I was in a relationship that I was feeling a little bit like stuck in, and a lot of things were going on for me emotionally. One, the main thing being that I was an actor who was not hitting what I wanted to in my career, you know, the sort of proverbial living in the basement suite and, you know, actress, waitress, and really looking for meaning. And at the time, I saw a film called What the Bleep Do We Know, which was also really big at that time.
What the Bleep Do We Know? 2004 film, scripted fiction film that presents quantum physics and human consciousness as being connected, a notion that is not endorsed by the scientific community. One of the film's directors was a guy named Mark Vicente, who was involved with Nexium and a follower of Keith Raniere. Sarah mentions Mark a few times in this interview. That's who she means.
My boyfriend at the time was a filmmaker. He got his film into a film festival where the director of What the Bleep was going to be speaking. And I really liked this film. I thought it was the beginning of my more spiritual side of, you know, growing myself. And I was really into setting intentions and my angel cards and things like that. And so when I had an opportunity to meet Mark, I jumped on it. And it's a kind of a long story, but the long and short of it is I, you know, really was aspiring for doing more than beer commercials, you know, and
you wanted some meaning for the work that you were doing.
Yeah,
you wanted to you had hit an obstacle. You had hit some, you know, a point that you needed to try to navigate around.
Yes. And then here's Mark saying, oh, like, if you like my film, you'll love this workshop I just took. And that was it. Like, I didn't research it. I just trusted him. I really admired him. I wanted to make conscious shifting media, not vampire TV shows. So it was really a lot of things, you know, community, meaning. I've had to do a lot of personal digging in the years, and I'm sure you'll ask us about our healing. But one of the things I really had to come to terms with is that on an emotional, psychological level, and I think this is where I was vulnerable, is that I wanted to be, many people do, want to be special. And the company right away anointed me with that and made me feel they love bombed me, you know, and it worked. Right. Mm. So
how did that work?
Well, it's, you know, it's a big organization. They really trump the leaders up right away. And for me, it wasn't so much with Keith. I really had this relationship with Nancy. I really respected her. I admired her.
And Nancy
Nancy's Keith Raniere's sort of right-hand woman. It was at the time.
Co-founder
of the curriculum. Yeah. And she's the woman on the videos. But when I met her, I was like quite, you know, starstruck by her and, you know, thought that she did amazing work. And I'd had all these personal, big emotional shifts, which we can talk about, we'll circle back to if you'd like, in my first training. So by the time I met her, I was just like, wow, I want to help people the way that you've helped people. And she really, as well as a lot of the leaders around her, kind of scooped me up and was like, your family. And like, we look for people like you, which is true. Like I was later trained to look for people like me who are have a big network and are outgoing. And like, you know, I've been good at sales since I was 10, you know, I had business cards and I did garage sales and babysitting and jewelry businesses. And I'm good at promoting whatever it is I'm into. That's just kind of who I am. So for me, they saw like cha-ching and they were like, she's going to grow Canada, which I did. And so they nurtured me and they, you know, put resources into me and like invited me on special trips and on the Bronfman jet. Like that was all very exciting for a 26-year-old out of work actress. You know what I mean? Like they gave me all the things, all the pellets.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because we do think of people, and I know this is often true with other cults, of people who are down on their luck, people who are searching, people who've had some trauma or something missing in their lives to that point. And it sounds like it was getting both of you to a next level that you desired to be.
That was the sell. Yeah.
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 But it sounds like it kind of worked too, though.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it had to. Like there's lots of people who will say, you know, if fuck it, threw the baby out with the bathwater, Keith's a sociopath, when they figured out who he is. But like, there was a lot of tools that were part of the curriculum that we both participated in that helped us in our lives, that did take us to the next level, that did keep us on track, that did give us accountability, that did help us with our communication, that did work through our limiting beliefs. It's just not created by Keith. That's the thing. You know, like if somebody really smart goes into a spiritual bookstore and gets the best of all the different leaders and books and gurus and cobbles it together and puts it in a 5-day training where for 14 hours a day, you're working at all your issues and all your limitations and confronting your demons and all those things. Of course, you're going to have huge breakthroughs.
I also say this, John, I don't know that, you know, had Sarah and I done our paths regularly in our lives, that we wouldn't eventually found some success in whatever we'd done, because that's what we were setting out to do. So, you know, you still had to do the work. There's no shortcuts. You know, you still have to participate in the laws of cause and effect and make good decisions. How many of those reality would have corrected for us, you know, by trial and error, and how many of those were because of ESP, we'll never know, or Nexium, we'll never know.
And ESP is the executive success program.
That's really what the program was. And Nexium kind of emerged as the name everyone's using, you know, since the controversy was exposed. But it was really executive success programs was the success programs that we were taking.
At what point did you go from being an adherent or a teacher in an executive success program that was goal-oriented to being members of a cult?
Well,
the moment we signed up.
Yeah.
We were always members of a cult. We said no.
Okay. At what point did you become
aware of it?
Well, like, did you start, was it all at once, or did you see little flags that you were choosing to ignore?
This is my favorite question, because I have a bit of a long answer. Are you ready?
Sure.
So it was on day one. The red flags happened actually even before I signed up, when I tried to get my deposit. But I could put my deposit down so I could get the 48-hour discount, because there weren't many spots left, you know, scarcity mentality. And closer to the time, I called the company and I was like, I don't know what I was thinking. I don't have $2,000, you know, and I had a conversation with somebody who basically gaslit me, you know, and said, you know, you're 26 and you don't have enough, you don't have $2,000 to spend on your success. And I'm like, no. She's like, well, how is that going to change? Clearly you have money issues. Are you going to work on your money issues, or are you going to stay in the same pattern? And I was like, okay, good point. And I'm like, well, also I can't be available because, you know, I'm an actor. And she's like, oh, so you're going to wait for your agent to call the shots? Do you want to be the master of your own ship, or do you want your agent to be the master of your ship?
Now, who's the specialist in sales now, Sarah?
I know, right? Well, I mean, listen, I did all these things to other people, just so you know. Like, I learned these skills and I did it to other people for years. So I totally own that. And I've had a lot of apologies to make. Trust me. But anyway, that was done to me. That was being gaslit. You know, I went anyway. I couldn't get my money back. Day one, there were so many red flags. But here's what's so brilliant. They set you up right from the beginning. They say, it's called preempt. This is what we were taught when we did this to others as well. You say, it's a success program. We're all here to grow, right? Wouldn't you agree that all successful people are aware of their limitations? Of course. Yes. Yes. Okay. So we're here to work on your limitations. Wouldn't you agree that when you hit a limitation, it's uncomfortable? Sure. No pain, no gain. Yes. So you're going to be uncomfortable. You're going to hit up your limit against your limitations. You're going to feel uncomfortable. You're going to feel the urge to bolt. You're going to feel the urge to leave. Or what are the things you do when you feel uncomfortable? What do you do? We eat, we smoke, we flirt, we want to get the fuck out. You're going to feel all those things. We just ask you to stay and work on those things as they come up. Now, totally truth in that, right?
Sure, but also preemption of your actions and the prevent
defense.
Also
preemption, yeah. Also prevention of, I don't feel good with here. Something's not right. I do not like this. I said I would stay.
More with Sarah Edmondson and Nippy Ames in a moment. Back with Sarah Edmondson and Nippy Ames, former members of the Nexium organization, which was led by this guy, Keith Raniere. Keith Raniere, background in multi-level marketing, starts this series of classes called Executive Success Program, or ESP, which becomes Nexium. One of those things where you always need to be spending more money on more classes. Hollywood actors get hooked, who bring in other Hollywood actors. You can read a lot about all of this online. We have some links on our show page. He had people call him Vanguard. Keith Raniere is in jail now, convicted of a bunch of crimes. Sexual exploitation of a child, possession of child pornography, sex trafficking, forced labor, racketeering, wire fraud. Has a 120-year sentence. Sarah Edmondson didn't know about any of this stuff when she joined NXIVM, but some stuff did seem weird.
I don't like this. They're asking me to call the guy Vanguard. I don't like it. I said I would stay. Okay, they're asking me to bow to somebody who's not even here. Okay, I'm gonna just, maybe I do have authority issues. Okay, I'll stick it out. Okay, they're asking me to wear a sash. I don't want to wear a sash. It reminds me of brownies. I had a bad experience there. Maybe it's just a bad experience. I'm just going to stick it through.
You're blaming yourself for all these things.
I'm already like, gaslighting myself.
All the things that your accumulated wisdom are saying this is a bad idea, you're turning around and blaming yourself for.
Yes, from day one.
Because they had anticipated that instinct in you.
Oh, yeah. That's what I'm saying. It was all preempted. And to the point where, like, they would even say things like, they'd introduce the things very slowly, one thing at a time. And they'd even say people often don't like the sashes because it symbolizes the growth that people have taken on their personal development. And some people don't like to pay tribute to what other people have done. This is a suppressive strategy. This is what people do who don't feel good about themselves internally. And they want to suppress others, which is a very normal thing from childhood. When you're 5 years old and someone takes something in the sandbox and we want to suppress them, but that's an old thing that needs to be rooted out. So I'm going, oh my God, I must be a little bit suppressive because I really don't like the sashes. Okay, I'm not going to tell anybody about that.
Yeah.
You know, so cut to 16, a couple months later, after I'd done my 16 day and I go to Vanguard Week, the retreat, which by the way, I couldn't afford to pay for. And they're like, well, why don't you work at it? They did what's called an ethical value exchange. So my boyfriend and I at the time were part of the film team, which was made sense for him, but I was basically like carrying his gear around so I could attend this thing for free. Anyway, I'm there on the first day. They do these promotions where everyone's going up the ladder of their sashes. And everyone's like clapping and paying tribute to Keith. And like, it's so amazing that I've had, and I'm going inside going, this is really uncomfortable. And I'm not even confiding in anyone because I'm going, it must be suppressive because I don't like the tribute and I don't like the promotions. And it's like bringing up all my shit. So that's how it, and it was always like that. And then it just got worse. It just got worse from there. So when you say were there red flags, there were red flags all the way along, but we learned, and Nippy and I were just talking about this the other day, we learned that like, and it starts small because one of the very first things they ask you is take off your shoes in the training room, And that's like, they say like, if you go to someone's house and they ask you to take off your shoes, you're like, sure, it's your house, right? So like, it's sort of presented that way. You just sort of do it because it's respectful. And at a certain point, you don't question anything because he's the authority. And it's not respectful to go, what the fuck are you talking about? He's Vanguard. Like, he knows more than I do. So even if I don't agree, I don't say it because it's disrespectful. And then I learned to go, but he's the authority because this is the ranking system that you've accepted. So as soon as you accept that there's that ranking system, just like you do in the military, right? Mm-hmm. Just like you do in many, many situations, even on a film set, the director calls the shots. Like you don't say to the director, sorry, I think we should shoot it this way. Like you don't do that, right? So it's a similar type of structure where you're just accepting things. And there's also, this term better than I do. What's the psychological term where like you just got to go along with what's happening around you because no one else is saying anything? What's that called?
Mob mentality?
Yeah.
Well, groupthink.
Yeah, groupthink, sure. So then in the years that you were in it, were you getting constant rewards of some kind that were making you stay? Were you getting a growing sense that it would be bad to leave? Like, was it a positive to stay or was it a negative to leave?
Okay. Both. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Can I answer that real quick, Nip? Sorry, I'm kind of dominating right now. Then I'll pass it back to you. Just to say, like, I loved the ranks. I loved getting to my next stripe and my next sash. It was very rewarding. And they grew me very fast, very quick. And then they stalled me for about four years just before the point where I would actually make money in the company.
Oh.
And that was like, And I talk about this in my book. It was a very, very painful time of being like I'd hit all the criteria except for one nebulous thing, which was my personal growth, which was, of course, decided by somebody else if I'd overcome my certain issues. And that was always the case. They always withheld promotions based on that. But I'd hit all the other criteria, which were not nebulous.
That sounds like where you were when you started with the group in the first place.
I know, ironically. So they really used our issues against us. But the other thing that was negative, and I'd learned about this when we did our cult recovery, is that like religions and other cults, they have things like planted phobias. Like if you leave, you'll die, you know, or if you leave, you're going to get cancer and live on the street. Or like there was really, but ours, I was like, we didn't have that. I'm like, no, when people left and people did leave, it was like, oh, so sad about Bob. He's never going to work through that issue. Guess he'll just have to. Yeah. It's like a pity, kind of like they're going to be stuck. What are you saying, Nip?
Well, there was also, I remember one person left to go to Tuck Business School, Dartmouth Business School, right? He got in. And instead of being happy for him, I remember one of the people said to him, it's like, if you leave, your conscience will start to degrade and you'll destroy your conscience if you do that.
I remember thinking that.
Edgar said it to him. And
when you heard that, did you think that's bananas?
I just rolled my eyes, but I thought that was him.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was him being kind of like pissed at him for leaving and trying to use an obligatory tactic to him. I was happy for the guy. I was like, that's great. Good for you.
Had you considered, either of you, that, hey, am I in a cult right now? Like, was there a revelatory moment of, oh shit, I'm in a cult?
Or
was
that it happened 12 years later? Thing? 12 years later.
I mean, yeah, we didn't really, you know, well, I want to address the original question in terms with the sashes and stuff like that. I lost respect for the ranking system pretty early on. So for me, when they would say certain things and people who were quote unquote outranked me that were quite frankly had never done anything in their personal lives and hadn't demonstrated anything outside the organization of merit, I just didn't have respect for them. And when they opened their mouths and they didn't necessarily demonstrate competence, the sash didn't mean anything to me. So it was more the person, and the ranking system to me felt like something that was just kind of there that I didn't really take to heart and internalize.
I totally did. I'd be like, Nippy, yeah. Don't you want to get your next sash?
And like, I would be like, no. Like, I would be like, you know.
I thought it was crazy.
That again, it's case by case. And also I found also too, the women were more bought in a lot of ways because they were targeted and gaslit differently. I was kind of left alone. Keith wasn't targeting me in the same way. So I'm not here to say, oh, I wasn't hoodwinked in the same way. It was just different.
Yeah. The way you were treated was different and your relationship to him was different.
And to the organization, they kind of left me alone a little bit because I was susceptible in different ways. Let's put it that way.
In that first 5 day that we were talking about earlier, they teach us that people will say we're in a cult. And they even say, you know, the word cult, and there's truth to this, is that it's vague and not specific. And especially in 2005, before Wild Wild Country and Going Clear and The Vow, when like people didn't really have all this knowledge that we have now, it was, cults were like Jim Jones and Shaving Heads and Goat's Blood and White Robes and
Hare Krishna
and Heaven's Gate and all that stuff. And we're clearly not doing that. So when people are saying you're a cult, you're saying there's something bad and they're not saying what is it. So the response is, well, what's bad about it? And truthfully, many people said I was in a cult for 12 years. And I was like, yeah, it's a cult of happy, successful people.
My mom called it that. She's like, oh, you're going back up to the cult?
Yeah. And some people said it more jokingly and some people said it more seriously. But either way, I was like, if I'm in a cult, it's a good one.
Mm. So it didn't bother you? Like the tag cult didn't bother you?
It didn't bother me in that, like, I couldn't see what was bad. It bothered me that people were like, would go online and say, you know, there's bad things written about Keith versus trusting me. That bothered me. I was like, yeah. I've had a good experience. I'm telling you, my life is better. You're going to read the internet? Fuck you. Like, that's how I felt more about it.
Yeah. And we also kind of dug in our righteousness that they were wrong.
Yeah. They just didn't understand. Right. They just didn't get it. You know, like if they took the curriculum, they get it.
You read something online. I went and took the training. You know how the media works, that sort of thing. So we had preemptive narratives. We had preemptive narratives to kind of deter people if we could.
Yeah. I watched The Vow with my wife, and it was really interesting to talk about it as it was going along, because I'm watching this thing about people with all the knowledge that a lot of the people in it didn't have at the time.
Right.
You know, the stuff about the sex trafficking and the true motivation for all this. And I remember saying to my wife, my instinct is to think, how can these people not have realized what was going on? How could they, like, were they stupid that they couldn't figure this out? And I'm sure you get that question a lot. It's like, how in the world, what kind of suckers are you that you fell for this? How do you respond to that?
We get it all the time. And it's actually one of the things that's motivated me to be like so loud about what happened. Because, you know, all the experts say it could happen to anybody. It's just a matter of being at the right time in your life, meeting the right person. And everyone knows, and you know this, everyone goes through stages in their life where things are not great. Either it's a divorce, it's a, you know, a change of a career, a death in the family, you know, life events happen where you're not solid. And if at that time you meet someone that says, check this thing out. And it doesn't have to be come to this seminar or sign up for this. It's like, come to my dinner party. Like that's, as soon as you agree to go do something, you're already in the first step has occurred. And it's not like in the 70s where people were being invited to a church meeting or to dance in a square or protest something. There's a lot of political cults and things like that. It's the first step really is like, hey, let's grab a coffee. And you say, sure. And I know what you're going through in your life, and I offer you something that's going to help you, and you trust me. That's it. It's not that hard. And like we're on episode 30 of our podcast, and we talk to survivors of all different kinds of cults: political cults, religious cults, individual cults, social media cults, all these different types. And everybody's incredibly. I mean, there's a diverse range of people, but everyone's quite smart. Quite smart, and I think the driving through line is that many of them are idealistic, myself included, and Nippy as well. Like idealistic, some people might swap that for naive, and definitely I was naive in that I didn't know how these things worked. If I had seen The Vow, I wouldn't, like when Mark invited me, I would have been like, wait, smartest man in the world says who? You know, like
martial arts champion was the one that got me.
Judo champion, trust me, age 11.
That's the one I went in on. I think there's a clip of me in The Vow going, judo champion, age 11. Like, you know, it's just rolling my eyes. I'll answer that question a little bit differently, but, you know, it rhymes. The reason I decided to go in with the podcast that we're doing, because I was in the inertia of no to a lot of stuff. I didn't want this whole thing to dominate my life.
Yeah.
Is because the abuses of power that went on inside this organization and cults are the exact same abuses of power that go on in most other hierarchies, domains, governments, everywhere else, bar none. Not at all different, right? There's some sort of persona that's put up with a clandestine agenda behind it. I mean, we could do shades of gray and all that stuff. And for people who think that they're not susceptible to it, in a lot of ways, they are the most susceptible to it because they don't consider that they're being conned. I was that guy. I was the guy in the fire there with my arms folded, just questioning everything throughout the whole thing. Okay. So, and do I make allowance for suckers and a little bit stupid? Sure. But for me, for the people that say that, I'm pretty sure I could go down the line at somewhere in their lives where maybe they've been susceptible and fallen for something like that. Now, the ramifications weren't the same, right? But if you look at the extremes that go on in our politics right now, which I'm super sensitive to the extremes of like both entities when they become extreme, the abuses of power sound and look a lot like the stuff that we went through in our experience. And so for me, it's super important to articulate what they look like and sound like and turn all that experience into wisdom so that people can understand the precursors and symptoms for these things. So when people say and act like that, I try to be patient, and then I try to figure out if they're seeking to understand it or just fortify their belief that it would never happen to them. And if that's that kind of person that wants to do that, then the world is full of people like that. And I don't feel like they're my audience.
But for people seeking to understand it, we can give you a good understanding of how it looks like and sounds like. I think, and I think Sarah and I have done a good job in doing that, and hopefully a responsible job in doing that.
Just ahead, why and how Sarah and Nippy got out and what their minds were like then.
Max Fun Drive 2022 starts in just 1 week.
Monday, April 25th.
We'll have exclusive Max Fun Drive gifts, awesome episodes, bonus content, and you know what else? You'll just have to tune in.
We have some tricks up our sleeve. Sleeves? Tricks? Is it plural?
We'll catch you next week, the greatest time to support the podcasts you love. Max Fun Drive starts on Monday, April 25th.
Don't miss it.
If you're sick of constantly arguing with the people closest to you about topics that really aren't going to change the world, we're here to take that stress off of your shoulders. We take care of it for you on We Got This with Mark and Hal.
That's right, Hal. If you have a subjective question that you want answered objectively once and for all time for all of the people of the world, questions like who's the best Disney villain, Mac or PC, or should you put ketchup on a hot dog? That's why we're here.
Yes, I get that these are the biggest questions of our time, and we're often joined by special guests like Nathan Fillion, Orlando Jones, and Paget Brewster. So let Mark and Hal take care of it for you on We Got This with Mark and Hal, weekly on Maximum Fun.
Back with Nippy Ames and Sarah Edmondson, scrutiny of Nexium had been going on for a long time, even before Sarah and Nippy joined. In 2003, an article in Forbes came out, very critical of the organization. The billionaire Edgar Bronfman, whose daughter Claire Bronfman was involved with Nexium, called it a cult. But Sarah and Nippy didn't get out until 2017. I asked them what it finally took for them to leave.
I've been having problems with the organizations for a while. Like, I just think it wasn't here. It's kind of like when someone, for most people you meet, when they give you a persona, you tend to accept that persona, generally speaking, until they do something drastically outside that persona, right? You might be frustrated with certain things that they're doing, but generally you're not going, they're a bad person, generally, if they're a friend of yours. I had been frustrated with the persona ESP, Nexium, all the organizations were fronting as success programs and not having people actually come in and demonstrate that. And it was going on within the organizations. I was always in Sarah's ear. I was always in Mark's ear about like why this has happened. So
can we upgrade the website? Like things
it was
like
just
that.
Frustrating to work for the organization with a lot of the incompetence that was going on. And Sarah, myself, and a bunch of other people were on the front trying to promote it and coming home and having to fight homes about getting paid on time. Like it was just a lot of like petty stuff where we were always scrambling to put out petty fires. And I just remember thinking, this isn't going to be the rest of my life. So I started pursuing other things while being part of the organization. So little things started to accumulate. I wasn't considering leaving because I still believe that the principles and tenets of the organization, the persona, were still authentic, right? When I started seeing the abuse, particularly in my own household, with my wife getting branded with Keith's initials, and then she didn't know that, and she told me, there was no intellectual debate around whether this organization was what it was anymore. And immediately, like in almost one moment, all the things that had been said about Keith Raniere previously became fact. So the doubts that I had that were all there, you know, what happened in 2009? What was going on with this Forbes article? Like all those things that had been kind of dismissed because I had gone to the people around him and asked, yeah. Right? My due diligence was, right. They had their answers and they armed me with those answers. All those things were true. And then it became, I had to figure out what I was looking at, right? And so I knew I wasn't looking at the persona that they were selling. I was looking at, and then it became who still believes Keith Raniere. Who knows Keith isn't really who he is and is perpetrating his lie? And how do I make those distinctions? And then I got to expose this guy and tear this down and I'm pissed. And then that's when a slew of other emotional things started to happen. And, you know, and so, but there's the moment of, oh my God, I'm the crazy one. Because I can remember sitting down, let's say, John, you and I went to college together. You knew me as a guy that was, you know, pretty normal. And I come to you and you're like, yeah, but Nip, look what I'm looking online. I'm like, come on, John. Do you think I'd fall for something like that? And you go, no. And you might take a 5-day and like it, or like you would be like, but I could feel where you believe the online article over me after I left the meeting and demonstrating by you not signing up, and think, damn, John fell for that. But knowing you thought I was the one who fell for it, and then having the reconciliation of like, oh my God, John was right. And every person I spoke to that got their information, so many people, online. John.
Kaiser Soze moment.
Oh, it was so like, you know, John, you have to understand. I went to these Ivy League events. I became head of the Brown University Ivy League chapter of this group in New York City. And I would run these events with all these other Ivy schools. I was, every time I stood up, I go, my name is Anthony Ames. I work for this organization, a personal professional. I was promoting it in a network of people that would, some would be interested, but most would look it up and go, who is this guy?
Right.
Like,
right.
In hindsight, I'm going, oh my God, like all the conversations. And that was just like the humble pie I had to eat. And then like not knowing like all the other abuses were going on and that he was sleeping with all these women and branding them. And that came out subsequently. I mean, it was just a series of hits.
Shit show.
Of like,
did you guys have that moment together of,
no,
holy shit, we got to get out?
No.
What was it for you, Sarah?
Mine was a little different. I similarly had some problems with the organization. People weren't getting paid. They were developing new curriculum and taking all of my staff in Vancouver, so I couldn't run my school. I mean, tons of things. In 2014, we had our first child, and my priorities shifted, you know, as they should when you have a baby. And I'd been trying to get to the next level of what's called a green sash, which is like the senior proctor. And that basically means you're like overseeing the proctors. There was only, I think like 13 or 14 of them in the entire company when I got to that level. So I was one stripe away at my orange sash. I know it doesn't mean anything, but so I had 3 out of my 4 stripes. And at View Week, where they do the promotions, remember the 12 years earlier when I was really uncomfortable? So now I'm there. I've got a newborn. And all of a sudden, they promote me, not to my next stripe, which I was hoping for, but they promoted me to green. And I found out later it was just to keep me in because I was like focusing on the baby.
Okay. Yeah.
I later learned they do things called motivational promotions. So I got a motivational promotion and it worked. I was like, oh my God, I'm a green now. I'm part of the green meetings. And like, it was like, Nippy didn't care. I cared.
But an important underscore. Sorry to cut you off, yeah, Sarah, but I think it's important. Fine. That's the kind of levers that were being pulled in the psychology and the forces behind the scenes that we didn't consider.
Right.
Does that make sense? So those are levers and those are manipulative things to keep us enrolled and keep us in thing that Sarah was susceptible. I was susceptible in different ways, but those are the forces that we weren't really sensitive to that were fucking with us, really. Mm-hmm. And we didn't consider that the people that we were working with were doing that proactively, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Like they were literally in our ears and we're getting like different advice from different people. And you know, as when you have a therapist, it's like a private thing. We had like, if you can imagine that the work we did was kind of like therapy, it's like we had multiple therapists with multiple agendas.
Who were unqualified.
Who were unqualified. And the therapist controlling all the therapists, Keith, was actively trying to have sex with me, which I didn't know. But like, that's what was, they were trying to break.
That was the motivation.
That was the motivation.
Right.
And he never did, just for the record. Okay. So he's trying to split us up. Nippy and I are having kind of normal marital things and also that we have a new baby and whatever. So we're having some challenges. So when you say, what was my trajectory to leaving, John, it's a little complicated. It's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, because it's, you can't even explain it in a 5-hour podcast interview. But the long and short of it is that I was struggling on the growth path and I got invited to join a secret society for women called DOS. And that group has a number of steps, which again, I can't get into without taking up another 4 hours, of inviting me, giving collateral, which is also known as blackmail, to keep my vow of secrecy, which ended up in me committing to initiation where I'd be getting a tattoo. And the night of, found out that it was not a tattoo, but a brand. And that was itself was actually not, even though it was horrific and like barbaric and very painful and trauma bonding and all the things that I believe Keith was trying to do is not actually what woke me up. It was a couple of weeks later when I had a conversation with Mark Vicente, the same guy who brought me in. He had figured out certain things that were happening in the community and was leaving. His wife had left earlier. So a number of things happened at a very short period of time. He was leaving. I was part of this weird secret society that was like kind of cool, but also fucked up. And like, you know, as part of this like, you know, elite secret club. But then part of it was now I had to give collateral every month. And Lauren had asked me for my deed to my condo that we're sitting
this
in
is
right now.
Lauren.
So, sorry, Lauren Salzman, the woman who is like my best friend, my godmother to my child.
She was one of my best friends.
Lippy's best friends. She was, she married us. She was our officiant at our wedding and our maid of honor. Anyway, probably the person I, like the way, in the many ways that people trusted Keith, I had Nancy and Lauren. So Lauren, that's who she was to me. And she had asked for the deed to my home. So all these things were like, you know, I was like, I got to get out of this. I didn't think I was going to get out of NXIVM. I just thought that this women's group was way too extreme, not what I signed up for, and totally fucked up. Meanwhile, Mark leaves. He won't tell me why until I sign an NDA. And when I do sign the NDA, he tells me that he's heard about this women's group, doesn't know that I'm in it. And what he knows is that women have been given the assignment once they've committed, because it's a vow of obedience, to have sex with Keith. And I'm like, what the fuck? Keith's celibate. That's what I've been told for the last 12 years. Keith's celibate. And all of a sudden, wait, Keith's not celibate? Holy fuck. And then I have to tell, I feel somehow safe under my NDA to tell him that I'm branded. And then that's when we figure out shortly after that it's not a symbol for the elements. It's KR on my body, K-A-R. It's initials. And that's really when everything came together for me. It's like the metaphor we talk about a lot in our pod is that when people wake up, and it's the same with like Mormonism and whatever thing you're in, is that you can't wrap your head around the events. You put it on the shelf. You put one event, next thing event on the shelf. And one day the shelf just collapses. So that was my collapsing, but there were tons of things that led up to it. It's not like I was completely in the dark and then I woke up. I was in the dark. I saw certain red flags from day one.
Well,
like,
our hangups were legitimized in our own mind.
Yeah. What have you done since then for your mental health? Like, what have you been dealing with?
Oh,
I imagine there might be some guilt, some shame. Depression seems very possible. What's been the process of dealing with your mental health in a post-NXIVM world?
It's, you know, honestly, it's been a lot. And we've gone through all of those things. I think the shame and the guilt was quite prevalent, especially for the first year, maybe longer. It's a bit of a blur now, but you know, to admit, basically I walked around to everyone I could tell being like, remember that thing I invited you to? Like, you were right. It was a cult. I'm like, I'm so sorry. Or if people were in it, you know, feeling so guilty that I'd brought them in it and making sure that they got, I mean, we really spent so much time just getting people out. Was what we did at first is like getting on the phone and walking and then through.
That was
and you can't,
bulk of 3 to 3 months, I'd say.
Yeah.
Right after.
And like on the phone all the time, because you can't just say, we're going to call it. You got to get out. You have to do it you have to ask questions and you have to have people kind of figure it out for themselves, because otherwise they're going to be like, oh my God. And then they're going to call Keith. And that's actually what happened is how we got a lot of people out before they knew that we'd woken up, you know, and we were in.
That's kind of the thing. We were in a fight.
We were in a fight.
We were in trauma, and then we were in a fight.
Yes, and so we also trying to like present to them that everything's cool, like business as usual. So I was like a spy. I felt like a spy for a good. Like I felt like I was living a double life, which is not good for your nervous system, by the way.
No.
And even just talking about it, I'm all like, you can see, I'm amped up. Like I had severe, I don't know if it's complex PTSD or PTSD, or I learned from Amanda Knox on your episode, Perry's PTSD. I don't know. I mean, I'm still dealing with it four years later. Much better, much better.
It's interesting to me because people think, oh, I would never join a cult. Just like I've heard interviews with con artists, like confidence scam operators who say, oh no, anyone can fall for this. No one is too sharp to catch this. And I think you both make that case very well. And it's a real service that you're doing. And I wonder if your skill in explaining that comes from practice and explaining
Absolutely.
It to yourselves and each other.
Absolutely.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah. That's a huge part of our healing. So to answer your question, I mean, the first part of our healing was talking to cult specialists. So people who could teach us what had happened so we understood. We read a lot of books, and I'll give this to you for your show notes if you want for your listeners, but it's my sarahedmondson.com/resources. And I have a ton of all the materials that we ingested voraciously, podcasts and TV series and books, which led us to very specific experts and understandings and models that we weren't thinking about the podcast at this point. We were just that just happened a year ago, but we were just in survival mode. We've got to fix ourselves so we can also, we're parents. So I think that really put a fire under our butts for our growth. Like we have friends that are reaching out to us now being like, okay, I think I should maybe get therapy. I'm like, you think so?
Yeah.
4 years later, but they just like wanted to hide under a rock. We couldn't do that. I'd been public. I showed my brand on the cover of the New York Times to expose this guy, not even thinking, whoa, that's going to have ramifications on my mental health. It's just like, this guy's got to go down and this is the proof. Like he's been abusing people for years, decades, and nobody was able to take him down. And now I have got the proof. I got the proof on my body and it's got to be shown.
You can't gaslight that.
You can't gaslight it. And I mean, they tried. Listen,
it just didn't work.
People would reach out to us, John, and it would sound like this. They'd be like, I heard you're leaving and I heard what happened and that you were branded. But what exactly is bad about that? If fraternities and sororities do it, it sounds like you made a commitment and then you got scared and now you're having a temper tantrum.
That's
what it sounds
get
like.
Get off the phone with those people, Sarah.
That's what gaslighting sounds like. Yeah. And I mean, I tried. I had an open.
I was more blunt.
Yeah, Nippy would just be like, go fuck yourself. There's no room for branding and personal development. Go fuck yourself.
Did you need to reach a certain plateau with your mental health before you could start on this podcast, before you could work on the vow to like make sure that you had your shit straight?
We jumped in and we found out later from our... It's still a process.
Yeah, I'm sure.
It's always going to be kind of a process in terms of, you know, understanding how these things work and what got yourself into it. Until it isn't, you know, I always say, you know, I know my best friend's over his girlfriend when he stops talking about her.
Yeah.
Right. And so Sarah and I don't talk about our trauma anymore. We've turned a negative into a positive. And that was that. And COVID was a blessing. The lockdowns 2 years ago for us in a lot of ways, because we didn't have any outside, you know, obligations. We hunkered down on our family and we watched The Last Dance. And I remember that was Michael Jordan's motto in his family. And his dad would always tell him, turn a negative into a positive, turn a negative into a positive. And the only way to turn it into a positive is understand how the negative happened. You have to understand the infrastructure of it and all that stuff. We're sensitive to it and it comes in waves, right? It comes in once you've peeled one back, like there was one I didn't even consider. It happened about 7-8 months in when a friend of mine emailed and kind of told me their experience of me when I was in and how they couldn't talk to me about things. That opened up a whole slew of other relationships that had I not been in this organization could have been nurtured for 12 years. And then there was the whole, where would I be now? You know, which for me, like Sarah's is different. Mine was, where would I be? Like I wanted these results and I'm very attached to my capacity to perform. And all that stuff I was at ground zero when all this was over. I didn't really have anything to show for it, you know, and in my early 40s. This is what I was feeling and telling myself.
So that was when you were kind of depressed.
I was in depression.
I said, what have we been doing? So I just want to summarize: cult therapy, couples counseling. I have a regular psychologist. I have a healthy, not culty yoga practice. I take a lot of CBD oil. We microdose psilocybin, Epsom salt baths, walks in the woods, writing, connecting, and helping people. That's my path for healing. So just to
creating.
Answer the question.
We're creating. So we're in a flow of creating, which I think is the biggest, it's a heals thing. Yeah. And we're doing it
and
together.
And we get to actually help people. Like before we thought we were helping people, but now we get to actually. And that feels really good and very healing on the other side. It's a real catharsis for us to do that.
That's why we're all three here.
And
and glad to have you alongside us in that effort. Sarah Edmondson, Nippy Ames, thank you so much for the work you're doing and for telling your story.
Thank you, John, for
having
us.
Thank you for having us, for the great questions too.
Sarah and Nippy's podcast is called A Little Bit Culty. For more information on Nexium and Keith Raniere, check out our show page. We have some links, or just consult the internet. You can also catch the HBO documentary The Vow, multi-part documentary, because the whole thing is very complicated and kind of shocking. As I said, Keith Raniere is behind bars now, will be for a while. He has followers still, talks to them by phone. They have organized dancing demonstrations outside the prison where he's held to protest his incarceration and try to recruit new members. I feel bad for vampires. Vampires don't need my pity. They got other things on their mind. But I feel a little bad for vampires and for zombies because, as far as I can tell, they have no breath. They don't breathe, and therefore they can't fully participate in a meditation moment with our friend Laura House. Hi, Laura.
Hello. I never thought that I was excluding them, but now I could give them a mantra.
Yeah, I kind of think they've made their choices.
All right, fair.
Yeah, they can be sexy and mysterious and pale, and maybe
there
they don't.
Go.
Maybe they wouldn't benefit from meditation, but I think that we can, and we're going to take a little moment to kind of find a nice place in our minds and in our breath.
Prove you're not a vampire. Mm. Meditate.
Yes.
So you just want to be in a place where you can safely close your eyes, so not driving, and ideally seated position. You can have your back supported. Close your eyes and just notice your breath. It's already happening. It's already doing it. So you're just noticing. And you'll have thoughts. And when it occurs to you that all your attention's in your thoughts, you just notice your breath again. Just keep letting go. You can go ahead and open your eyes. Renewed. A new person.
Renewed, yes. It occurs to me that zombies are actually pretty peaceful most of the time. I don't think they've got a lot of thoughts complicating their heads.
So. I don't think they have complicated thoughts, but they always seem on the move.
Yeah, they're always on the shamble. And if I wonder if they eat the brains of somebody who is stressed out, if that transfers.
Oh, if it makes it work. Yeah. That would be like, that's the catch 22 of zombies, because everybody is stressed out being chased by a zombie. So they could never, I guess someone would have to be asleep for them to get the calm people. I've said too much.
And this has been Conversations You Don't Normally Have Surrounding a Meditation Session with Laura House from the Tiny Victories podcast. You can check her out there and at laurahouse.com. Laura, thanks.
Thank you.
Next time on Depression Mode, long before John Darnielle was an acclaimed popular musician, he was living on the streets of Portland and doing a lot of drugs, for reasons that made a lot of sense at the time.
I'm sure that I know that there are psychological explanations for why a perfectly intelligent kid is taking drugs that can really severely harm him. But the only answer I can give as the addict who was taking them is because it felt amazing.
If people support our show through a small donation, we can keep being here together. If not, we can't. If you donate, you make Depression Mode happen. We thank you. If you haven't donated yet, it's easy. You can find a level that works for you. Go to MaximumFun.org/join. Hit subscribe on Depression Mode. Do it now. Give us 5 stars. Write reviews. That helps more people find out about the show, which helps our mission of getting those conversations going. Please know that the Suicide Prevention Lifeline is available 24/7 for free, 1-800-273-8255. That's 800-273-TALK. The crisis text line, also free and always available. Text HOME to 741741. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, check out our discussion group, Preshies. We're on Twitter and Instagram at DepreshPod. Our newsletter is available on Substack. Just search up Depresh Mode there. I'm on Twitter at John Moe. Hello, credits listeners. The band The Cult was originally called Death Cult, a name based on the singer's previous band, Southern Death Cult. The cult has broken up and reformed a few times, proving it's hard to get out of a cult. They're touring with Alice Cooper this summer. Depresh Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hey, it's me, Marnie, from Utah. Why don't you go take a nice hot bath?
Depresh Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.